Welcome to The Sacramentalist, a podcast where the ancient Christian faith is brought to bear on issues prevalent in modern culture. We're your hosts. I'm Father Creighton McElveen.
And I'm Father Wesley Walker.
And today we are joined by Lance Davis to discuss the Anglican Office Book, which is an incredible resource which he has compiled and published. Welcome, Lance.
Thank you, Fathers, for having me.
Yeah, we're really, really excited for today's conversation. A little bit of background on Lance. He is a minister of sacred music and organist at St. Luke's Anglican Catholic Church in Augusta, Georgia, not too far from me. He's a graduate of Oral Roberts University, where he studied patristics and linguistics. And he has a certification with the American Guild of Organists, having completed organ residencies at York Minster and Southwark Cathedral in London. He also serves as the Latin educator at St. Andrew's Anglican Academy in Chester, California. And he has recently completed his master's work in theology and is an ordinand in the Anglican Catholic Diocese of the South. So congratulations on that.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, so we are very excited. I know Father Wes and I have had many conversations about the Anglican Office Book over the years, and you were pretty quick on getting a first copy, right? I think you got yours kind of early on, right after it was published.
Pretty early on, and started using it regularly. You can tell it's well loved. Cool. You know what they say, an Anglican office book that's falling apart, is it the sign of a life that isn't?
It's true.
Put that on sacramentalist merch.
That's right. The ultimate niche merch.
Yes.
Well, I mean, that's our whole deal.
That's true.
All right. Well, first of all, Lance, could you give our listeners who may be unfamiliar with the Anglican Office Book, the breviary tradition, anything like that, a sort of brief explanation of what the Anglican Office Book is and what are some of its sort of features that make it so important and valuable in their prayer life?
Well, simplest way to put it is that the Anglican Office Book does for the daily office of the prayer book tradition what the various missals have done for the office of Holy Communion, which essentially in this case means to take the structure and format of the prayer book office, in this case predominantly that of the 1928 prayer book, and to restore to it those elements that characterized the hours of more ancient liturgical practice, pre-Reformation predominantly. Now, following the general way the prayer books have developed, I made a decision to base this material on material largely from the Sarum use, because again, we have a lectionary, for example, in the Eucharistic rite in the prayer book that largely follows the Sarum cursus, and so I wanted to keep that theme. Now, what I think makes the AOB different is not that it is a unique publication. There have been books like this produced in the recent past. Really, in some sense, you can find supplements to the offices, of course, going back to the Caroline period and even earlier. But certainly, once we had the Oxford movement, and there was all the scholarship that opened up, particularly into Sarum, and we had retranslations of those rites. John Mason Neal, of course, and all of his work, he did the Sarum Breviary. Many of the orders began to use elements, at least from Sarum. By the mid-20th century, there was clearly a desire to have some form of liturgical not revision, but an enhancement in a systematic way to the prayer book offices, as was occurring in most parishes with the communion service already. Two works that were notable as far as this endeavor goes were what was called the English Office Book And it was first produced at the very end of the 19th century. And it was the 1662 office with just a few additional collects and such to allow an expanded calendar of the saints and of the seasons. And that went through several editions, culminating in the last edition of 1955, which is an interesting work. It's hard to find in original form now. It was bound with all the readings from the 1922 English lectionary, but following the High Church Party in England at that point in time, it adopted the rubrical reforms of Pius XII from 55. And so it created an interesting middle way office between the earlier tradition and then what eventually came to be 1962 and then the Novus Ordo. In America, the only real work that did the same thing to this extent was Father Paul Hartzell, who compiled a book called The Prayer Book Office. And it originally came out in 1944 and had two subsequent editions in 63 and 67. And he sought to restore many serum elements, a fuller calendar, to the 1928 office. But he did it in a way that by using his book, you didn't have to be encumbered, as it were, with the editions if you didn't want them. I can't prove this, but I think part of it was a nod towards keeping the rubrical integrity of the 28 intact and not making it appear as if he were adding things to the ordinary as the Episcopal Church had approved it. So if you wanted to use the prayer book office, you had to go to multiple different sections to find your hymns or your collects, your antiphons. And so while the content was excellent, and he really did a wonderful job in making it mold with the prayer book tradition, the book itself was a bit unwieldy. And then by 63, he had worked with the Prayer Book Studies Commission in its earlier days, but he began to be influenced by the liturgical movement as it had developed at that point. And so there were some more ad hoc changes he had made to the office. And by 67, he had really created this office that was entirely of his own mind, loosely based still in 28, but he had what he called a world calendar, where he thought we would fix the date of Easter, and he was convinced that this sort of thing was going to become commonplace throughout the Christian world. And of course, he campaigned for many of the things that later came to reality, such as removing Septuagesimatide and these sorts of things. So those latter two editions, interesting to see the development of this certain style of Anglo-Catholic liturgy in the Episcopal Church, not particularly helpful today. So my idea was the Anglican Office book should take the best of the work that was done before and put it into a format usable and, dare I say, approachable by anybody. Because the only other source we have had in English that at least is conformable to the 1928 rite is the Anglican Breviary, which I think is a wonderful production. But as those who pray the Breviary know, it does require a certain amount of finesse to learn the rubrics. But the bigger problem, I think, is that an awful lot of people are just unable to consistently pray the full round of offices. And the Psalter in the Anglican Breviary is such that you will miss out on large portions of the Psalms if you are unable to commit daily to Matins through Compline. And so though I am by no means a detractor of the Anglican Breviary or of Pius X's Psalter schema, it's not terribly practical for most laymen and even most clergy today. So the AOB is able to do for the prayer book what the Anglican Breviary was trying to do, but in a way that is still usable and doesn't require the little hours to be done. You can still follow the 30-day Psalter or one of the two-week schemes that will be in second edition and get the entire Psaltery prayed regularly with no more than 15 to 20 minutes twice a day. So that's really what it was. And I've been amazed by the reception. It was really a pet project that I intended for my own personal use that sort of blew up beyond what I anticipated. And yes, Father Creighton, you mentioned that Father Wesley was an early adopter. I remember you joined the Facebook group, I think the first day it came out. It was when I started the group, within an hour, we had 500 members.
Wow.
Which is what really sort of impelled me to think, well, maybe there is something here that's a need in the church, and hopefully it can meet that.
That's awesome. I love that. Now, I think probably some people can kind of piece this together where you'll go with an answer, but I think it might be good to draw this out a little bit more, because obviously one of the philosophies that undergirds the Book of Common Prayer, not just as a worship book, but also as an ascetical system, is that a life of prayer is not just for monastics. It's for the laity as well. And this, of course, wasn't unique to Cranmer. It wasn't unique to the English Reformation, but they did heavily emphasize it. And so how do you see the Anglican Office book as carrying that emphasis forward?
Well, at the risk of perhaps overstating the utility of the book, I would argue that the AOB is in some sense a culmination of Cranmer's vision. That perhaps for cultural, political, practical reasons wasn't entirely possible at the time of the English Reformation. I don't think we have to get into any kind of party debate to recognize that the office had, by and large, certainly in the forms it took in England, become an exceedingly beautiful and glorious production. And it just wasn't being used the way the office ought to be used by the church as a whole. And so we can't fault Cranmer for wanting to restore a sense of the office to every parish church, to re-monasticize England, as it were. But there were practical decisions that he had to make. And eliminating the little hours, I think there was no good way, if he wanted to restore a firm sense of the office as a foundation for the practice of the church, then going to a model that was morning and evening had the most utility. However, I don't think that we can argue that in so doing, there was necessarily an intent to forbid all that had come before absolutely. I mean, obviously, you had the examples of Little Gidding and many others, Lancelot Andrews. And so this sense that there were hours of prayer that could still be used beyond Matins and Evensong, it remains in the English church. And of course, we all can speculate as to what may have happened had the monasteries themselves not been dissolved. So the AOB keeps what Cranmer intended. And in the cursus of the little hours in the AOB, they are intentionally kept short and largely unchanging. And this is a point of departure, perhaps, from the Roman and Sarum traditions, both of which had, at least until 1911, a fixed Psalter at little hours. But even putting that aside, the little chapter, the antiphons, these sorts of things would vary by the day or by the season. And so when I was putting this together, I looked at some other books that have been produced by Anglican clergy in the past, one of which was called The Priest's Manual of Devotion, It was quite popular in England. It was first printed in the Victorian period and went through something like 15 or 16 editions well into the 1960s. And it's a fascinating look at the development of Anglo-Catholic spirituality amongst the clergy. It was meant to be a clerical book. For example, it went from largely being the 1662 book with some variants of the Lowers thrown in to, by the 1960s, having most of the priest's private prayers only given in Latin, the rite of communion, of course, being essentially the Roman rite with the Latin canon and that sort of thing. So they had an approach to the Lowers in that book that drew heavily on Benedictine use. So it used the gradual psalms, but only varied antiphons and such seasonally. So there was little variation to it, but just enough to keep it interesting. And if you weren't able to pray all the Lowers, then of course those psalms were covered by Matins and Evensong in the prayer book. So I used that as my basis for the AOB. I chose the gradual psalms because of one, their length, but also, again, this sort of Benedictine emphasis. Psalm 119 is a lovely psalm. It can become a bit drudgery, shall we say, if you have to pray it through every day. And that is why I myself, again, in popular opinion, tend to prefer Pius X's revision of the office as a historical, in some senses, his Psalter might be. There's a utility there that's important. So I think what we have done with the AOB is take Cranmer's approach and say, you can now begin to sanctify the rest of the time throughout the day, like was the universal tradition in the church from the earliest days, following the same sense of simplicity that has made the prayer book rite not only so influential, but I mean, let's face it, it has been adopted by both the Orthodox churches and by Rome in some form, which tells me that there's a great usefulness to that approach and a necessity for it in the church today. And so now the AOB has that as an option. As an aside, though, to that point, for those who do pray the little hours consistently and regularly, there's going to be another two-week Psalter scheme in the second edition that will follow the sort of Pius X approach and will have short, variable psalms. Shorter than he provides for, again, to keep that idea that these are five-minute offices throughout the day. But I know that there are a good number of people that have made it their custom to pray all of the hours each day. So this will, again, allow maybe a little bit more variety without losing the idea of what the Lowers are meant to be.
That's helpful. Now, one criticism I've heard of the AOB, and I do not share this. In fact, I think it's bunk. But I was just having a conversation with someone yesterday who, ironically, this person is a Roman Catholic who, it's a long story. But anyways, he says that one of his issues with the AOB is that it overcomplicates what is a very simple and elegant BCP office to the point that it's unapproachable. That was his argument. I think this is just not true, but I'm curious how you would respond if you heard someone talk like that about the AOB.
Well, I think my first question would be, well, then what would you consider to be approachable? I mean, certainly we couldn't consider, in my opinion, either the Roman Breviary or the Liturgy of the Hours to be such. In fact, I would say Liturgy of the Hours is less approachable than the Roman Breviary. So with that said, I would say, look, the AOB keeps the entire structure of Cranmer's office and does not complicate it any more than the average parish mass has complicated the simple and elegant communion service in the prayer book. You know, I have never experienced a parish that did, say, a straight 1928 or 1662 liturgy as written with nothing else added to it, meaning no hymns, no additional collects, no minor propers, not having the Benedictus after the Sanctus. I have never experienced that, and there's a reason for it. There's a reason that really from the beginning, whether it were metrical psalms or hymnody or what have you, the liturgies in the prayer book have been embellished, shall we say. And of course, we do that at its best when we embellish them with material from the tradition and not something created in committee in the 1960s. But nevertheless, I think there's a more fundamental issue here that is at stake. And this is partly what led me to publish the AOB. There is a disconnect, or has been in many cases a disconnect, particularly in Anglo-Catholic parishes, parishes of the continuum, between what goes on Sunday morning at the Mass and what goes on daily in the office. The Mass and the office are interrelated. You really cannot separate one from the other. Pius Parsh, the liturgical scholar, in his book, The Breviary Explained, he relates this to the analogy of the Mass being the sun and the hours of the office are the planets revolving around it. Or the Mass is the jewel and the divine office is the centerpiece for it, is what frames it. And what happens, I think, is particularly in our parishes that use the Missal, is we will have this beautiful historic rite of Mass with all of the saints' days observed and all of the seasons, and then we'll go pray our office, which is completely stripped of all of that and has no actual relation to what we just did at the Mass. And this is particularly noticeable with the saints' days. You know, Anglo-Catholics, for example, generally love to have the full cursus of Marian feasts. Well, aside from the purification and the Annunciation, all the rest of them have no collects provided. So it would seem odd to me to say Mass for the Assumption and then to go read Evensong and pray the previous Sunday's collect. So what has the AOB done? Well, in practice, all that is added to the simple elegance, and I will agree with that phrase, of the prayer book office, are hymns, one. There are two hymns added at Matins and one at Evensong. There are antiphons on the Psalms, which is there are always only one antiphon, especially on feast days, and an antiphon on the New Testament canticle, the Benedictus and Magnificat. Other than that, the only addition are collects for the entire cursus of the year. So the reality is, again, have either of you ever attended a parish evensong that didn't have hymns added to it? I mean, you know, my career has been spent as an organist, and I've been very fortunate to have worked in some really lovely parishes, both of the Anglican and the traditional Latin uses. And the idea of going up there and doing a 1928 evensong as is, with no choral anthem, no hymns, none of that, I I've never seen it done. I'm not convinced it does happen anywhere. So to say that it overly complicates, I would actually say, what is more complicated? Sitting down and doing liturgical planning for the office in your parish where you have to figure out what hymns you might want to use, this, that, and the other, or just opening up the AOB and saying, hey, that's what's appointed. We can sing it to some melody everybody knows, and that's that. And we're letting the church's tradition do the work for us. And I really, I think that is an argument made by somebody who probably hasn't really spent much time actually trying to live into the tradition.
Yeah, I would say too. I mean, you know, even if you're fairly new to praying the office, I think the AOB is very approachable. Quite the opposite of something like the breviary. Like you said, it requires finesse. I mean, you have to get out the ordo and figure out exactly what to do. I mean, honestly, I spend about as much time figuring out what I'm going to do in the office as actually praying the office. The AOB, I think you can set that up in probably 3 to 5 minutes. I mean, realistically, it's really not hard.
No, you're right. And that was part of my goal with it. And the second edition in particular, you know, there were one thing that may set the AOB apart, let's say from the Anglican Missal, is the Missal sometimes assigns different rankings to feast days than the AOB does. Usually in the direction of the Missal will give a higher ranking to feasts than the AOB. And there's a practical reason that many feasts are observed purely as memorials in the AOB. And one of those practical reasons is to prevent too much of what you just described, of having to sit down and figure out, okay, do I have to consult the tables of occurrence or concurrence and what takes precedence? But in those cases where these could be real questions that occur regularly throughout the course of the year, in the second edition, I have gone to, I think, about the greatest lengths you can possibly go to put in the rubrics, in line, in the propers, this is what you're going to do today. In a way that the breviaries just have never done, and for practical reasons they couldn't do. So again, you talk about the simplicity of the English office. I think the AOB is trying to maintain that in a way that nevertheless allows for a fuller sense of the liturgical cycle.
I think it's interesting too, just as an aside, that you often hear criticisms that the sort of, let's take the Western patrimony as a whole, it's too complicated. It's too, you know, whatever. It's this big complex machine that's moving around, and it's these feasts here and feasts there and celebrations here. But I think criticisms that say things like the Anglican office book is complicating a simple, you know, sort of elegant service, make a sort of fundamental error that that complication is like a bad thing, that beauty or nuance or whatever is negative, that it detracts from one's experience in worship. But the reality is it helps facilitate our worship. It helps us understand the transcendent sort of numinous quality of worship itself. But that doesn't mean it has to be hard to use. And there's a difference there between complicated and hard to use. And I think, like with the Anglican Office Book, it's still complex in a positive sense, but it's easy to use. It's accessible. Other books for the Divine Office might be complicated and hard to use.
Right. I think you're onto something there. And again, this is just purely my own experience, but I spent 8 years as organist and choir master at a parish run by the Fraternity of St. Peter, so traditional Latin Mass. And immediately after that, spent 5 years working for a parish of the Episcopal Church. They used the 1979 book and all that went along with that. And as someone who was deeply involved in, shall we say, liturgical planning and execution of liturgy as an organist and director of music, I have to tell you, the older rites are much more coherent. They're far more straightforward. And once you understand the rhythm of them and maybe how the books are laid out, it's a far simpler task, even if the material itself might be more complex. you know, working through the modern liturgies with their multiple year lectionaries and optionitis galore. I mean, you sit there and you spend more time in that case, I think, figuring out which options you want to choose than you would ever spend sitting down with a Roman breviary, for example, and saying, oh, okay, well, tonight is first evensong of such and such. It's really not that difficult. And personally, I think that oftentimes these criticisms are made from a place, in some sense, of unfamiliarity, yes, but also a bit of fear. I think sometimes, particularly if we consider this for public liturgy, there is a fear that because of modern attention spans or these sorts of things, that people won't understand. We should be able to come to a parish and, regardless of what background we come from, easily digest what has just happened liturgically. I find that to be a peculiar perspective, and certainly not a terribly historical one, as far as the church goes, East or West. I would rather say, how about we learn to live in a liturgical cycle, not worry quite so much about whether it's easy or difficult or accessible or not accessible or approachable or what have you, and let the liturgy do what it's supposed to do, which is form us. We want to form it. That's the modern mentality. And everyone is guilty of that across the board. And we're never going to get past a lot of these issues in the church broad today until we change places in our approach to the liturgy. Let the tradition speak to us, learn to live it, and don't worry about having to take control of everything all the time.
I think that's a great point. I always try to remind people that we're the ones being formed, right? We're not the ones doing the forming. Mm-hmm. But so one of the reasons that we wanted to have you on to talk about this coincides with the fact that pre-order for the second edition of the Anglican Office book is now live over at the St. Andrew's website, and we'll put a link to that website in our show notes for any listeners or viewers who want to check that out. You've kind of answered some of this already, you've touched on it, but why a second edition, and what does it have that the first didn't? What are some of the changes? Just sort of walk us through that process.
Well, the reality is I didn't know what I was doing when I produced the first edition. Typesetting a book, particularly a liturgical book, is not for the faint of heart. And when I started it, it began as a COVID project, really. I was living in New York City at the time, and as you can imagine, when this all began, New York became a somewhat hostile environment in some respects. So I came down to visit my family in Georgia and spent a few months down here and took some of my book collection with me and got this crazy idea that, well, how come no one has reproduced one of these office books in the last 50 years? So it began entirely as a pet project that I thought maybe I'd find a private publishing company, have a few copies for myself, and that would be that. Well, my dear friend, Father Brian Foose, who's the headmaster of St. Andrew's Academy, I was talking to him about this, and he is a man that has no shortage of vision about anything. And he says, well, let's publish it. Well, I don't know the first thing about any of this. And so he was real insistent that we do this. And so he got the funds together, found a benefactor who was willing to support the print run. So we started to do that. But the reality is, by the time we made that decision, I had done so much work into the first edition that going back and making any major corrections to the typesetting or even alterations would have required an amount of work that I wasn't sure I could commit to at that point in time. So we released it, And again, it was very popular. And I received so many comments from people thanking us for producing it and saying that, you know, they'd waited for years for something like this to happen. And it also struck me where these people were coming from. Yes, the majority were Anglicans of some variety, but you know, Roman Catholics, Orthodox of Eastern and Western persuasion, Methodists, Lutherans, you know, all across the board. There was something about it. Even people that would write to me and say, well, you know, I'm maybe not quite on board with the Communion of the Saints. Maybe I can't quite bring myself to address a prayer to one of the saints, but I found so much use in the rest of the book. And, you know, so I was thinking about that response and talking to my publisher. And of course, we knew that we'd have to run a second printing eventually, and probably sooner rather than later. And so I told him, well, let's hold off a little bit. I would really like to retypeset the whole thing. If we're going to do it again, then let me do it the way it ought to have been done the first time. I'll learn the software properly and go through and really try to make it look like the best of the breviary tradition in terms of typesetting and such. And so the easy part, in some sense, was copying and pasting all the text. The hard part was in going through and completely changing everything. Now, we changed the font, we changed the organization, the structure. But there was one other thing that left the first edition incomplete for me. And that is that it was not a complete office book. In the Anglican tradition, of course, you have to have the cursus of Scripture. And it makes sense if you pray your office in the church or if you pray it at a prayer desk at home, that you're doing it twice a day, you would leave a Bible next to your office book, and that's fine. But again, when I've produced something that has the Little Hours, that has several pastoral offices in it, many other offices of devotion that could be used throughout the day, it seemed to me that we needed to have all the material bound together. My initial idea was, well, since this is largely a book for the American church, we'll put in the 1943 lectionary readings, knowing that probably nobody is totally satisfied with that lectionary, but it is what we are generally stuck with right now. And of course, those tables are in the AOB. And I was talking to my publisher about it, and I said, but you know, there is a problem. In some sense, it might limit the usefulness of the book because we also have two other lectionary tables in the back. You know, the Canadian 1962, which I think is a wonderful lectionary, and is approved in the G3, certainly. And then we also have the 1549. And by binding in the 43 lections, you would still need to have a Bible with it. And as we all know, there are, what, two editions, certainly of the authorized version, that have the Apocrypha bound in right now, neither of which are terrifically portable. So Father Foose says, we'll just put the Bible with it. I laughed, and the idea of typesetting the Bible, which we would have to do. I mean, there was no elegant way to do a photographic reproduction, which is really what everyone does now for the authorized version, for the most part, at least all the ones with the Apocrypha. So I scoffed at the idea initially, but began to think about it and said, well, if you're going to do it, you may as well do it the best way you possibly can, that will have the most usefulness for people. And the reality is, I have to keep in mind that the AOB needs to generally conform to a liturgy that can be used publicly. And since I think maybe the one thing that perhaps all the Anglican jurisdictions have in common is that the authorized version is at least permitted, if not required, for public readings of Scripture, that made the most sense, one, and two, just putting it all together. that was a bit of a Herculean task. Now, I've had people ask me, did you have to hand type the entire Bible? No, thankfully I did not. There are plenty of resources that have been checked over and over and over again for the text. But I will tell you this, we had to, for space reasons, put it into a paragraph format. And of course, generally speaking, the authorized version has been produced, verse by line kind of format. So even going through and having to translate all of that from line by line into paragraph, I mean, that I couldn't even tell you how many hours of work that was. Because I was insistent that we not change the physical size of the book. Being portable, I think, is very important to the usefulness of the AOB. But also making the text legible. So it went through several revisions before I finally settled on something that I think will have the broadest appeal for the Bible. But we've got the Old Testament, followed by the AOB, followed by the New Testament, and then with the apocryphal books at the end, which I have been careful to say is not a theological statement. They are only at the end because this, again, is an office book. And the reality is those books are read the least. And as anybody who has had a larger, for example, the 28 King James combo that we have, the end of the New Testament can begin to separate from the binding. And we don't want that to happen. So I figure most people probably are not reading 2 Maccabees terribly often. And so putting those books at the end was purely for practical purposes, keeping the book as strong as we possibly could for as long as we can. But it is done, and I hope people will be pleased with it. It's no frills. We couldn't put in any of the verse references, cross references, these kinds of things. But again, there's plenty of material out there for that if you need it. This is an office book, but now you can use all three of the lectionaries and still have just the one book. And I'm pleased to say we switched to a thinner Bible paper than the first edition. So we're only adding about 0.8 inches to the thickness of the book, which will still make it thinner than either the Anglican Breviary or the 28 King James combination.
And Lance, when could people expect, if they pre-order now, about when could they expect to actually receive it? I know some of that's out of your control, but just in general.
So the most I know that I can say, the publishers or the printers are working on it right now. They are hoping to have the whole thing done by the end of May. Now, it's going to take longer than the first edition, and there are two reasons for that. One, of course, it's a much longer book. We went from 700 and something pages to 2,200. It is produced on a much higher quality paper. It will have 10 ribbons bound in with it, a higher quality cover that also has a quite more elaborate design on it than the current one. I have intentionally withheld that from public consumption until I have a copy of the book to show. But the thing that we really can't control is once they print it, they put it into a barge and ship it to California, where St. Andrews is. Last time in 2020, they had told us it would be about 2 weeks on the barge. But of course, we were still in the midst of all the COVID stuff. And it took them about twice as long to just physically to get the books offloaded. So as much as I would like to be able to give a date, we unfortunately, we just can't predict that. But we are certainly hoping that books will begin shipping in June. And my publisher has assured me that first come, first served in terms of the pre-orders. Because you have to keep in mind, they're a pretty small outfit in terms of getting these mailed. I mean, they've got 4 to 5 people that really will work on mailing these out. And so when you've got several hundred orders you have to get out immediately once the books arrive, the first people who ordered them were the first ones getting the mail. But we've had a very good showing so far.
We should say that the packaging that they come in is actually really fantastic. At least the first edition was. I assume there will be a similar caliber for the second edition, but it was quite an experience just opening it. In fact, I almost didn't want to because it was wrapped so nicely.
We had several people who wrote to me saying that they got their razor out to try to just slightly cut the top of the packaging so they could save it. I have not yet seen what's in store for the second edition, but I am told it will be of a level of elegance to match the second edition itself. So I will be surprised too.
Well, that I think we're all looking forward to it. I think it should be really fun to kind of dig into it, especially on like my end, right? Because I'm kind of like a office nerd and liturgy nerd and things. So if you were in my office right now, there's just like, I think 4 or 5 different office books over there. There's like 4 or 5, but they're all different. They're all, you know, so I have to add it to the collection. Got to have the second edition.
You and I share the same passion. I have more office books than I should admit to.
Yeah. There's whole sections of missiles and office books, and it's overwhelming.
You know, I just acquired, to speak to your nerddom for a moment, I just acquired a complete set of the Pre-Monstra Tension Breviary in 4 volumes, the last one produced in the early 50s, which, by the way, was the only other Latin use that had the Serum Cursus of O Antiphons in Advent, the only other one that shared them. And I've been piecing that set together for several years now. Very hard to find, as you can imagine.
Oh, yeah. And I think there's probably only 8 or 9 other people looking for them. And so you're competing on all the different auctions.
My last volume I was looking for came from Brazil, of all places. I didn't know they had a presence down there, but apparently they did. Well, you will be pleased to know, as someone who likes the breviary tradition, that we have expanded the offering of Latin in the second edition. We have the meal blessings before and after given in English and Latin and a few other things as well. So again, an attempt to draw on the broader tradition and provide something that might make the book a bit more interesting or set it apart from what's generally on offer right now.
Yeah, I think that's great. Just cover as many interests and people as possible. Mm-hmm. Well, that brings us, I think, to one of our favorite sections, which is what we're into. Lance, since you're our guest, what are you into?
Well, I think the answer I'm supposed to give to that is I am into my preparations for canonicals, but I'm going to put that aside for a moment. You know, I have been reading a book rather piecemeal lately that was gifted to me that I have found really quite fascinating. It's called Easily Satisfied with the Best. And it's by a priest, Father Darwin Kirby, who's now deceased. You may know him. He was rector of St. George's in Schenectady, New York. And this was a private memoir that he published in 91. It was never given to anybody aside from some friends of his. And a friend of mine managed to find a copy of this and gift it to me. And I suppose it's in the vein of something like Merrily on High. But the big difference is Father Kirby not only gives his amusing anecdotes, but he really gives a blueprint for how to build an Anglo-Catholic parish. Because when he inherited St. George's, it was snake belly low. They didn't want anything, vestments, none of it. And he claims within 2 years, transformed them to one of the highest and most Catholic parishes, really, in the Episcopal Church. And I think there's a lot to learn from his approach to it. And so I've really been trying to sketch out an outline of his advice, how he approached this, and thinking about it just sort of in my own context, both as someone who works in the church, you know, as a musician, but also as someone who is pursuing orders. But other than that, I suppose what I'm into when I'm not reading and working on the AOB is I have finally recovered my love of the bagpipes. I took up learning them after years of wanting to, right before COVID hit, again, living in New York, and then everything shut down. And so now that my master's work is done and the AOB is done, I have finally gotten back to that. And I'm not sure what my neighbors think about hearing me walk around in the backyard with them, but they'll get used to it. A little culture never hurt anybody, I suppose.
Exactly. Well, Father Wes, what are you into? Bagpipes?
No, nothing nearly as refined as that. I guess I need a little culture too. I think, well, the weather has gotten so nice. And here, it's actually been a little cooler than it normally is this time of year. So I've been outside a lot. Specifically, I've recovered kind of my love of bicycling. So I've been riding my bike around a lot. I bought a bike during COVID. I forgot if it was with Biden bucks or Trump bucks, but one of them, I bought a nice bike and, you know, it was riding around. Where we used to live had a ton of trails around. And so I rode that. And then we moved to a little bit more of a crowded area. And there's not quite as much by way of trails, but I've been getting back into it anyways, just because it's so fun. And the other outdoor activity that we've been into, my wife and I in particular, but also the deacon at my church, Deacon David, and a few other friends, pickleball. Which I know is supposedly for old people. In fact, I don't think I've told this story on here, but Deacon David and I at a synod last year, went to a racket club to play pickleball. We had to go down a day early because he had to be examined by our board of examining chaplain. So we had a free day. So we found this racquetball club and we went, and it was like Tuesday at 10 and there were like probably 70 people there, but they were all over the age of 60, except for me and Deacon David. And so we jumped into some games with some older ladies, and they kicked my butt. I tell you what, they absolutely did. And of course, perhaps my language was not fitting for a priest being beaten by these 60-year-old women. It was pretty awesome. So anyway, so we've really been into pickleball lately, so that when I go back to play against the retirees, I don't get it handed to me quite as bad. Father Creighton, what are you into?
Well, I'm doing a reread. This is probably for the third time. I think it's the third time. Reread of Jean Danilou's God and the Ways of Knowing. I've got a little project cooking, and so I needed him. So I needed to get into the nitty-gritty of this particular book. So I'm really enjoying it. I'm already, I love his writing style. So I started it a few days ago, probably halfway through. And yeah, there are a few other, as listeners probably are aware, sort of my area of academic and specialty interest is sort of de Lubac and sort of philosophical theology, resource mod, that sort of thing. So yeah, if this project comes to something, then I'll tell the listeners, but if it doesn't, then I'm just enjoying a great book. So yeah, it's really good. I recommend people, if you're sort of interested in, I'm not going to call it epistemology because it kind of is and isn't. If you're interested in how Danilou approaches sort of weaving together philosophy, religion, epistemology, sort of all into his vision for God's self-revelation in Christ. I really recommend it. It's really interesting. Yeah, it's good to sort of keep my mind working. I think the last couple times I said something I'm into, it's been really mundane, embarrassingly mundane. So really enjoying it. That brings us to the end of our episode, though. We are really, really thankful, Lance, that you came on. If anybody is interested in finding any more about the Anglican Office book or what you're doing, are there any ways they can get in touch or contact you?
Well, the easiest way would be go on to our Facebook group and send me a message. I do my best to reply to every single person that posts on there or sends me a private message. I'm happy to answer questions and tell you what I can.
Awesome. Listeners, viewers, if you are interested in supporting the show or getting some extra content, please remember to check out our Patreon. You can follow us for $5 a month, and you can join the Communion of Patreon Saints. We have all of our social media is usually posted with the show, but if you like us on Facebook, please check out our Facebook group. You can email us with any questions or comments at thesacramentalists@gmail.com. And wherever you get your podcasts, you can rate, review, and subscribe, as well as on YouTube. Father Wes, will you give us a blessing?
Yes.
Straight out of the Anglican Office book? I'm just kidding.
Sorry. I was unprepared.
I threw it at you.
You did. The peace of God, which passeth all understanding, keep your hearts and minds in the knowledge and love of God and of his Son, Jesus Christ, our Lord. The blessing of God Almighty, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost be amongst you and remain with you always. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you, gentlemen.